Hello, everyone. If you would like to get lit with us, then the next book, which Andy is so excited for. He's been waiting years for this book.
Stupid years.
We are reading the second book in the Crossfire series. We're reading Reflected in You, which is the coveted second book to Bared to You by Sylvia Day.
Stupidest podcast ever.
So put this in your eyes and ears however you want. Go to your local library, ask them, make sure they walk you to the area where you have to pick out this book.
Of your favorite librarian, yep.
Yeah, go to your local bookstore, kind of explain the premise to them a little bit. Have them walk you there too. Yeah, however you want to do it, then put it in your eyes or ears.
If you like this podcast, which you definitely won't after listening to this episode and reading this book, please tell someone else about it. If you want to do the technical stuff, then liking this podcast, subscribing to the podcast, even reviewing it on like Apple, iTunes is very useful. If you want to get in touch with us, you can at littlelitpod@gmail.com. We're on Twitter at pod_lit. I am on Twitter at AWKLEMA. At the time of this recording, I will have posted my blog post of all the reviews of books I read in 2022. So if you want to check that out, because it has everything that we did on here, including links to the episodes that we did for those books, as well as some other books that I read that were outside of the podcast. Yeah, definitely check that out.
Yeah, I'll put it in the description.
There you go. See? Teamwork.
Look at that. Teamwork makes the dream work, and I hope that you guys don't leave us after we read this book. So,
'cause I will.
Buckle up. Yeah, please don't leave me.
Fuck, I already messed it up.
Wow, you actually sound like you have a podcast voice.
I don't know if I should fight you or thank you.
I'm really happy. I'm also drunk.
Are you trying to press record at a certain time anymore, or like are you trying to do it before we record? Did you want to catch pre-pro stuff? Should I remind you?
I don't think, like, once I know that we're done with like legit pre-pro, like once we've like nailed down, I guess I could record the entire time.
Well, you mentioned it one other time when we had like a somewhat interesting conversation. You're like, yeah, we should catch that. And then like, and you had the idea of like, well, why don't I record a little bit more early on? Point is like, did you think that was a bad idea, or did you just like not?
I just didn't start doing it. I just didn't do it. I fucked up.
Do you want me to remind you?
Yeah, if I forget to do that, remind me. You're a bad friend for not actually doing that this time.
Yeah, I've been trash for.
I've been trash for many years.
I think we all know that.
Well, this is Lit Lit.
All right, podcast where
everything that Andy touches is trash, including himself. Uh-huh. That was a really bad sentence. That was bad.
This podcast is off the rails already.
So what happens when you start drinking at like 11? This is a podcast where we read books soberish and we talk about them drunk. My name is Danny Burford.
And I'm Andrew Cleveland.
And besides my vulgar comments, we're going to be talking about the last book in our trilogy. Yep. The Hero of Ages by Brandon Sanderson, the Mistborn trilogy.
Indeed. Long ass books, huh?
Long fucking ass books. Well, long ass books.
They were. I feel like they're not as. I've read some other fantasy that drags more. But I mean, we can talk about our feelings on that in a minute. But yeah, these kind of. There's a lot there, and there's a lot to therefore discuss as well.
Yeah.
As a very brief summation of this particular book, let's see. The force known as Ruin has been released, and as we saw in the second book, The Well of Ascension.
Mm-hmm.
And now Vin and her husband, Elend, are basically one of the humanity's last hope type deals where they're trying to save the world from something that's trying to destroy it. There's a lot going on as far as the individual people's motivations, as well as the places they're going to, and like the ways in which they might even do that. But I think we might as well just get into all of that too, mm-hmm. rather than having me describe it. Did you like it?
I did like it. I did.
Yay.
I was nervous. Nervy going into this book. I definitely think that there were some things that should have been introduced in the second book. I think the third book was really, really good, but it also was just like bang, 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 bang. Like, it was so much packed into what is still a very mm-hmm. long book. I kind of mm-hmm. wish that there were some of those key things that happened in the third book. I wish we could have like sat with them a little bit longer as readers in the second book.
Sure.
Is there anything
in particular that you're thinking of just off the bat, or is it
writing in metal feeling? I wish that writing in metal was introduced into the second book, because that's something where I'm like, that could have been introduced earlier.
Well, it was, but it wasn't introduced as something that actually became practice, because if you remember, because again, these are really dense, there's a lot going on in each of these books, and this is a general you, not you, Danny, a terrible reader, but if you remember in the second book, when Sazad takes sees the engraving in the basement of that cache, that they find, and it's all done in metal, and then he notes it. He does a rubbing of it.
Oh yeah,
and then
like you do in kindergarten.
And reads it into his metal mind. Yeah.
Yeah, but wrong.
So like. Yeah, and then it gets twisted over time by Ruin, because that's one of the things he's still able to do while being imprisoned. So this is something that happens numerous times during the course of this series. There are concepts that are introduced of in passing, or the breadcrumbs are there. I will definitely tell you that from the beginning. The theme of this whole series could be the Kelser quote from the very first book. There's always another secret. That's the majority of the third book, I would say. But I will say that the breadcrumbs are laid there from a very early time for most of these things. And it's very interesting to see how it plays out. And also interesting for me to read it a second time and to be able to find them, because I know what I'm looking for now as well.
Yeah, that was my biggest thing, was I just wish that not everything was kept for the third book.
Which is totally fair.
Because I think it would have been the writing, or like the understanding of writing in metal would have been really fucking cool to see happen throughout book two, or like start realizing if Sazed Sazed had a moment of realizing wait, this is a little bit different than how I remember it, or wait, is it a little bit different than this and that. And it also was weird to me knowing that he read the metal wording and then just totally forgot what that said.
Well, that was the nature of his metal minds, the way he stores the information, kind of coming back to bite him in the ass in that regard, because the words, Ruin does start to change words on paper towards the very end of the second book, when he's trying to lead Vin specifically to the Well of Ascension, as well as making Sazed believe that she is in fact the Hero of Ages and everything like that. But it's towards the end, and it's a much shorter section as far as that goes. But the way that Sazed gets screwed over by that is that he reads that thing, he immediately puts it directly into his metal mind, where apparently Ruin can still affect things.
Right.
But the way the metal minds work is that you essentially just put your memory into it directly.
You're
aware that you did something and that you read something, but you store that memory in something else, and therefore it's out of your brain. So he didn't really have a good basis of comparison going forward, because he didn't remember as vividly what he was doing. I understand. I'm just.
I know how they work. I read the whole thing.
I know metal mines.
I know what they do. I would be a great one, because they have jewelry. That sounds fun.
your nose ring is the thing that keeps you from drawing the Mist Tower over and over again.
I will say, Another thing that I wish would have been a little bit like the Kalos thing,
mm-hmm.
of them being human. I wish that that was like a little bit earlier on, because it was like definitely hinted at. I know for sure, like that was I knew that sure. they were human. Like I called it. I just wish that like
yeah.
The main players would have like figured it out a little bit sooner. It's one of those things where, as much as I did really like this book, and I think this is like an issue that a lot of trilogies like this have in general, and mm-hmm. or like books like this do in general, where the main characters who are supposed to be like the smartest, the most, blah blah blah, everything like that, they like don't ask questions, and or they yeah. like, and I understand that that was a point of Ruin, where he was able to get into their minds and like really be that yeah. forceful, but it also was just like there were like no questions being asked there, like that kind of thing, which I don't think is just like pertinent to this book. I think that happens a lot of the times.
Yeah,
but yeah, I think that that was something else too.
I think that we talked about it a little bit in our last episode when we talked about the second book, The Well of Ascension, because we talked about how like Vin just like gets distracted from looking for, you know, that spy that's Ugh. In the group, like from the yeah. like, and that's one of the things like there's a lot going on, and I get that there's a lot going on, and therefore maybe it is plausible that like some of this stuff kind of goes by the wayside and you kind of forget about it, but you're not wrong.
Yeah,
it's still there, and it still is something that you, that could be a little more believable as far as the way yeah. that like these characters' minds work and what they'd be thinking about, what they'd be trying to uncover.
I know that like looking back on it, like oh, like she kept on getting distracted because of Ruin. Like she was getting
yes.
But then I wish at that point it was a little bit more. It was at that point. It's like too subtle. It's
a really tough line to walk, right?
It's like, a really tough line to walk, and sometimes yeah. it feels like when an author does that, that they're using that as filler. It's kind of like, it reminds me kind of like, oh, are we in purgatory? Like, you can't just, like, you don't just get to use this one thing, like, oh, Ruin is able to, like, read minds, and Ruin is able to, like, change everything that then Blinket covers all of your bases, because you... So, like, that's just my little two cents. I wish it would have been a little bit more, like, a little bit more grand if that was going to be the overall thing.
Grand in what way?
Like, I wish it would have just been, like, I don't want to say obvious, because I don't want it to be obvious, but I wish it would have been, then I wish it would have been a bigger deal that she didn't look for the spy. Like, I wish it would have been, why didn't I look for the spy? Like, why I doing this?
Yeah. I think that's a lot of just, like, juggling plot lines.
Grip it and fucking rip it. Did we hit ourselves?
Yeah. No, no, just kind of like it splashed a little bit. It's okay. It's fine.
Gross. What are you drinking?
This is a Juice Juicy from Evergreen Brewing, which is out of Camp Hill, Pennsylvania, which is very close to where I went to college, actually.
It's a Juice Juicy. That's what it's called.
J O O S E.
Juice.
Juicy. Yeah.
Juice Juicy. Mm-hmm. I don't like
Moose Juicy.
I don't. Ooh, that sounds really gross. Did you see? You definitely haven't. Well, you might have. It was a TikTok at this couple's wedding, and I think they're getting married in, like, I don't know, fucking Alaska. I don't know, somewhere high up there. And during their wedding ceremony, which is happening outside, a grizzly bear attacks and kills a moose.
Oh, wow.
Like, literally, like a football field away. Like, there's
like over there, pretty much.
Yeah. The videographer, you can hear him go, holy shit. And everyone is like looking, and these couple is like literally standing at the altar together, and they're yeah. like giving vows and stuff, and then it's just this fucking grizzly bear taking a moose out in the water,
which is fucked because moose are huge. Ridiculous. Yes, exactly.
Anyway,
almost as big as a Kalos. Oh, I don't know. No transition here. I will say, like, I think the Kalos thing was very it was interesting. I think that it was not that impactful a reveal overall. Mm-hmm. I think it was like a cool, like, almost like And it's a little bit like body horror type thing as well, where you're like, oh my god, that's fucking crazy. But like, it doesn't really have a huge like bearing on the plot overall, I would say. But speaking of, why don't we discuss the ending a little bit? Because I think that like, otherwise we're gonna kind of dance around talking about it. So we might as well just get out of the way.
I love dancing though.
And I don't. I know. And I should say, like, spoiler for anyone who wants to read this book and wants to know how things turn out, whatnot. We already gave a little bit away in this, but.
If you're on book three.
we are on book number three, and like we're about to give the whole goddamn game away. So like, if you don't want to have that experience, if you want to have that for your own, and I honestly very much recommend, that experience for yourself.
It's a really good series.
The last like 150 pages of this thing are just, over and over again, reveal, like big events that happen. So like, just FYI there. Mm-hmm. But to dig into it, like. Was that a good enough payoff for this series as far as you're concerned?
Yes. I would say yes. Like, I thought the ending, they did a good job. I love that Elend was decapitated.
Yep.
Like, I think that it did.
Which sounds like such a hater-ass thing to say, but I get it.
It finally gave us, like, deaths that were, one, on screen, and two... Mm-hmm. were warranted. Like, these were the types of things were like, oh fuck, like this is legit.
And you got you got some like everything's still okay type stuff, but at the same time, like, it was still an event itself to mm-hmm. have the deaths of Vin and Ellen in this book.
And what is a crazy thing that for me was I was reading this book while also listening to the last, like, three episodes of The Adventure Zone, like, of the entire arc.
Oh, my God. Balance?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
So, like, I currently have, like, maybe 45 minutes of, like, final part two.
I won't say anything then. Okay. Because that is reveal after reveal after loose ends being tied together and everything too.
And it felt like I was listening to it, and then I would read this, and then I would listen to that, and then I would read this, and I would be like, oh my god, what does life even mean? Like, who are we?
And let's throw that in there too. If anyone listening to this is not aware, The Adventure Zone, done by the McElroy Brothers, is a D&D podcast that starts out as kind of like a goof, like fuck around type thing, and becomes like an actual collaborative storytelling exercise. The first story is called Balance. It's like a 70 episode arc. Brilliant, like just and ends so nicely mm-hmm. too. I'm not going to spoil anything else for what you might get to, obviously, but like it's a really really well done series, and like. I mentioned very early in this series, the Mistborn series, that Sanderson's strength was plotting.
Yeah.
And that's why. Because I couldn't tell you, like, hey, the end is a huge payoff. Because then you're just going to read this thing, like, waiting for it to finally matter at the end.
That is
what he's good at.
Yeah. The plotting in this, especially because I was a little disappointed with the pace and plotting in the second book.
And agreed on that.
Yeah. And I'm super... interested to see the little breadcrumbs that you found earlier on, because it's your second time reading this, that might made the second book a little bit more of a payoff than it was for, like, me. Not that, you know, it was, like, the best book in the series by any means, but
yeah,
I can imagine, like, even looking back and seeing, like, those small little, like, breadcrumbs that Sanderson did leave for the overall plot was really, really cool. And I'm not... necessarily bummed that there were so many like reveal, and we didn't have that in the second book. I just think that some of the reveals that did happen could have been like written in, like, we could have had more time with them. Like, I think that would have been
spaced out a little bit
more. Yeah, I think that it would have been cool to have like certain things where they're unraveling a few things, but then leaving like all of like the huge kind of reveals towards the end. But
I don't disagree. I think that, like, there's... Well, I love the rapid fire nature of like kind of them understanding a whole bunch of stuff like right at the end. Like the ATM misting thing is amazing. Especially because it comes after there's already what you think is like the reveal. There already is the reveal of like the reason the mists were making people sick is because they were making them into Allomancers. Yeah. That's a big deal. And that's a cool scene by itself, because then they realize that the attack on Phaedrix isn't guaranteed to break through because they've got all this extra line of defense that they didn't know about. And like, if you're a good reader, of course, I'm sure you could put together some dots and be like, wait, but wasn't there that other group of them?
Yeah.
So why does that mean? I'm not saying it's impossible to figure out, but I like there's this little like Russian nesting doll type aspect to that.
So I was of two thoughts about the mist and about people getting sick. I either thought that it was Ruin who was like using that to place metal into people, or using that to like pierce people and then be able to control them in some way. Or I didn't necessarily think that they were being turned into Allomancers, but I definitely did think that the mist was like helping them in some way. Like, I didn't think that the mist was evil,
but isn't that like a wild like continuum of things to believe? Like, if you're a character that's going through it, you're like, well, shit, if it's either Ruin or it's Preservation, I have no idea which is which, and that's kind of fucked up, because now I don't know where to go with this.
And there was a lot of people, and I'm sure like a lot of people that didn't even know what Ruin and Preservation were. Like, that also wasn't widespread.
Most of the characters didn't know this.
And that's another thing that I think that this book would be, or this storyline would be, so fucking cool with spinoffs and having like someone that is in like the army, someone that, you know, or like the history of the Kalos, like that kind of shit. I think because he is so good at plot and story and like building out this world, that I'm interested to see it from the perspective of someone who's not the Emperor, or someone who's not a god, someone who's like that kind of vibe.
Sure.
Like Spook.
So yeah. So one thing I'll say right off the top is that this is part of a larger story telling enterprise by Sanderson as well.
I figured.
This takes place in the Cosmere universe, COSMERE. He also has like an epic fantasy series that's supposed to be 10 books in the end, I think, called the Stormlight Archive. I think it's through book 4, and maybe into 5 right now. And that takes place in the same universe. I don't know how much he ties these things together.
Gotcha.
I don't know if it simply is like, oh, you know, oblique references, or if the plots of these things end up tying together in some meaningful way. He also wrote another 4-book Mistborn series that takes place in like a steampunk type era, where technology is actually kind of advancing because the Lord Ruler has finally been deposed, and therefore you have actual advancement and not like stagnation.
Yeah,
because that's what the Lord Ruler was doing on purpose for stability's sake, was stopping anything that was going to challenge his rule. Now they even make reference to gunpowder in those books. I don't know if you remember that, but so there was originally what I think Mistborn was supposed to be a 3-book series, this one, a 3-book series like steampunk type era, and a 3-book series like modern era. And then he wrote something called like Wax and Wane, which was taking place in like a Western type setting. And I read the first book of that series, and then because originally it was supposed to be like a one-off thing that he did, like, ha, I had an idea and I wanted to write it real quick. And that turned into a 4-book series.
Oh, wow.
I have not read books 2 through 4, although I probably will this year at some point, because now I want to see where it's going.
Yeah.
But the point is that like he has a larger universe in mind for all of this, and I wonder how much he gets back to it.
Well, there's still 2 medals that haven't been discovered.
Yeah,
that was my only thing with the end, where I was like, you motherfuckers.
He's keeping it in there.
Yeah, like, and then when Sayes was like, there are 2 more medals that I think you would like. Like, I think that you would be interested in. And I'm like, just fucking write them. Put them in there.
give me the percentages and everything in the alloys.
Give me the key. Like, what are you doing?
I think that that was... So I like that there's a lot more to this story even after the story is done. But I also I bring this all up to say that, like, I wonder if he will ever go back and write, you know, short stories or novellas or, like, maybe even, like, full, like, you know, like, sequel prequel type series of, like, imagine writing this series of, like, the rebirth of humanity following, like, Spook, Demereau, the general.
Yeah. Breeze.
Like, Breeze, Beldre, Ariana, I forget how to pronounce his name. But yeah, yeah, right. And Yeoman, by the way, from Phaedrex, who ended up being one of my favorite characters in this book, going back to it a second time. And I'm gonna put a pin in that for a second. We'll talk about it in a little bit. But I did want to ask you, before we get to talking about all of the reveals here and all the larger meanings behind it.
Yeah.
Which of them did you kind of see coming, or were you mostly in the dark, or do you have some ideas, or, you know?
So I kind of saw that the Kelsier that Spook was talking to was not real.
Yes.
What else? Well, I mean, I called the Kolos being human. The mists. I was like between for the mists, trying to think of like other ones that I called or that happened. I figured that Elend and Vin were going to die.
Okay.
Not necessarily in the way that they did.
Sure, sure.
Especially
Vin is achieving godhood essentially and sacrificing it for, you know, the destruction of ruin as well. Yeah.
What were some
other
ones?
Do you have anything for the Chondra? Because you mentioned, I just remember this because, like, when we were talking about the second book and in the podcast, you had been like, yeah, it was kind of cool that those, like, those little Chondra culture things got mentioned. Like, it's probably never going to come up again. But and I would just sit there going like, because obviously I knew it was going to come back around. And to be clear, like, we've gotten burned on too many stories where that would have absolutely never been talked about again. So this is no shade whatsoever. Yes, we have absolutely been hurt before. And I will name names, damn it, Shadow and Bone. I will do it.
Yeah,
yes.
No, I didn't call that at all. I honestly didn't think that they were going to necessarily even be that big of a deal.
Yeah, for sure.
But I will say I did call that they were, that the Chondra, the Kolos, and the Inquisitors, is that what they are?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
All had spikes in them.
Spikes, yeah.
So I did, as soon as I was like, oh, okay, they're that. I did call, I was like, so, okay, they all have spikes in them. But did not call that, like, those were the terrorist people, did not, like, that was
a
really
cool reveal.
Yeah, that was
crazy, cool
right? I will say that Zazed really fucking annoyed me this book for a lot of it.
Yes, yes.
It was, and I get that he was being mopey, and I get that he was like, nothing matters. Yes. But, and then the realization that he was like, oh my God, like, I turned my back during the time where, like, hope is what mattered. Like, I can't believe I did this of all people. And I'm like, yeah, you're fucking annoying. Stop listening to sad boy songs and, like, fucking buck up, bud. Let's go.
Just someone who's been through a breakup playing Screaming Infidelities on repeat. Like, yeah.
We don't need to listen to Spanish love songs like every single like walk through the park.
My version of this was Cheek to Cheek by Starting Line on repeat freshman year of college. So yeah, that. Spanish love songs, it would be, oh God.
I've had some friends that I've recommended Spanish love songs to, and they're like, I'm not ready. Like, I'm not in a safe space. I'm not in a mental safe space.
I got super into Brave Faces, everyone, because we've talked about this a little bit. Like, we saw them play with the Wonder Years in late January of 2020, and I got super into them in February because I tracked down that album and, like, started listening to it aggressively. Yeah. And then the pandemic happened, and almost every fucking thing in that album still applied to the pandemic as far as, like, the emotional toll and everything like that. Ugh. Woof. Yeah.
I wish to
bury myself in sad boy songs, but I understand why someone would not be ready to.
Wish that they would release. So Sean and I went to go, we saw them again with the one, like, starting opening for the Wonder Years. And we got their album, which was a rewrite of Brave New and
Etc. Yeah.
And that is so fucking good. Because if you thought that that album hit during the pandemic, this was rewritten during the pandemic. Oh my God. That's a song that, well, that's a vinyl that like I'll put on and I'll just like stand in the middle of the living room and cry. And that's probably, it's probably what Sazed was listening to as well.
Yeah, as he's like reading through his I wonder if like one of the metal minds has like has a audio function where he's just kind of like listening to like something internally the entire time.
You know what actually he would be listening to? I feel like he would be listening to what is like a sad boy, like Reliant K.
Oh god.
Because it's religious.
Well, I was gonna say he's a religious sad boy. Yeah, exactly.
So now I'm thinking of like Third Eye Blind, or like thinking of like sad religious bands.
Oh man, I know more of these two. I don't know why I'm blanking on the ones I'm thinking. Under Oath is a little screamy, but like that's not really his. That's not really his.
No. I was gonna say Mayday Parade isn't. Up, yeah. Mayday Parade isn't religious, right?
No, they're not. Thrice.
Oh.
I don't know if they were outwardly religious or if Dustin Kutcher just has some views himself. But either way, so I will say, like, for me, that's the biggest thing that lags in this book. That really that drags. That you know, come on, man, gets to the point situation, which is Sazed's super emo sad boy phase. And like, to be very clear, of course. Like I understand.
Yeah, the woman that he met 4 months before, who he fell in love with.
No. Who he knew before, but had an emotional relationship 4 months before, or a year before, whatever it was. All the reasons why he sad tracks. It's more about Sanderson's focus that we're talking about here. Yeah. It's not that the character himself doesn't deserve, you know, to be the way he's feeling. It's the way that Sanderson drags it out and mines it over and over again for what feels, in my opinion, like repetitive commentary.
It felt like I was being over and over and over again, but there wasn't enough like breadcrumbs to open up like why should I care about this more so than just me being invested in this character in general. Like there wasn't enough for me to be like you're the fucking chosen one. Like it's you.
And I get why Sanderson wants to save that one, because that's a big deal. That's the last 15 pages, like Sazed becoming God. Like that is totally fair as a reason for tamping it down. But I agree that the problem is that then you don't get enough to have it carry you through all the rest of the muck instead.
Yeah, I wish that there would have been, maybe he didn't know he was God, but I wish that there just would have been like a moment that like he started believing in Vin a little bit more, or he started believing in like. Earlier on in the books, or not books, earlier on in this book, and like,
I wonder something like having him like reluctantly accept his role as like the announcer, I think is the actual title or something like that that was given. Because I think it's Holy Witness that Ruin changes it to, but it's announcer that is actually used.
Yeah.
Point is, if he had some kind of knowledge of that role and he was like reluctantly. Going along with it, for example, and like, okay, I have to do my duty for this, not just as the ambassador for Ellen Venture and his empire and whatnot, but also like to the larger issue of ruin versus preservation.
Mm-hmm.
That would have been a nice way to kind of keep us in it a little bit while still giving him something to be striving for, and then have that kind of get flipped a little bit at the end to be like, oh no, I'm not this guy. I'm guy at the end.
Do we ever have a last name for Vin?
I don't believe so.
I don't think so either.
I'm pretty sure that was described. The reason for that was given. I'm pretty sure that nobility are the only ones that are given surnames, and Scott never are. I could be wrong on that front, but I think that is the in-text reason for that to be happening.
Yeah, I can see that this book would. I think that this series would be a really good second read because, like. Thinking back on it, and like once you realize that Ruin is basically in all three books, that it must, like, I can imagine that this on a second read or, you know, something like that, where you start, you know what's happening, seeing everything dissolve and seeing everything kind of like turn chaotic must have been really cool. Like, were there moments for you that you were like, oh shit, like I know why this is like this conversation or this, or did it kind of take it too far of where you were turning every conversation into a, oh, is this ruin?
So
I also don't think I've ever asked you a question during this podcast.
I think you have, but your point is taken, because that did sound, that did feel weird. Yes,
it sounded very interviewy.
The other person that I occasionally interact with on this
my
podcast.
My co-host, when you were reading this book for your second time.
I feel like it's weird because it's really cool to see some of those breadcrumbs that are being left by Sanderson. Like I mentioned while reading the second book that Zane, as he's dying and a voice is talking
insane
to him,
Zane,
telling him he wasn't insane, insane. That one's really obvious. So like, yeah. less so that one, but like I mentioned that it was really cool to have Vin and who she thought was Osure talking about the Chondra culture and how that actually does very much come into play in the third book. I thought that was a cool little one. I love that like Kelsier saying like there's always another secret in the first book is basically is telling the story of the first book, but it's also telling the story of the whole series at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say that having foreknowledge of all of these reveals and plot twists and devices and everything like that, it makes it a little bit of a slower read because like you're kind of waiting for those things to happen to a point, or you're what you're reading, you're kind of looking for the information that's eventually going to get us to those big final reveals. And so some of the plot drags a little more than I wonder if it did for you, because I know what the stakes already are. I know what's going to happen in the end, and therefore some of the third book even feels like them kind of running around and like being occupying time to a degree.
Yeah.
like that you have certain characters that are on screen doing things that matter, but it's all to get to a certain point of setup, and that like when you already know what that setup is, it does last a little bit longer. It kind of drag a little bit in that regard. Like I'm thinking of a Spooken Utreo or whatever, or the name of that city
is.
Yeah. Like that whole plot line, I remember what happens with it. I know how the process goes and everything like that. So I'm just kind of like, all right, like let's get to where it actually matters. But like, that's not Sanderson's fault, obviously.
No.
That's the way in which you would read something like this, because you are trying to pick it apart for clues and because you're trying to tie it all back to the thing that you know that happens at the end. So it's a little bit of a weird experience reading it for another time. Like it was very cool when I saw things I didn't see before, and there were plenty of those.
Like, but what was like some of your favorite ones?
I'd forgotten that Yeoman, for example, reveals himself as an ATM misting. Because he burns ATM, so Vin thinks he's a Mistborn, and then Ellen thinks he's a Mistborn because of that same, you know, the same information. And that makes plenty of sense, of course. But I forgot that there was like a specific like dialogue section where he says, yes, I am a misting, and I burn ATM. And like you don't really search for those. It's too valuable to just randomly give to people, and like that makes total sense.
Mm-hmm.
But I forgot that was a little bit more. That was a little bit extra of a, these things are possible. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then eventually, when you get that big reveal towards the end, like, oh, that's right, because Yeoman was too. Yeah.
To me, that to me was like a cool reveal, but it was also one of those moments to me where I was like, why would they not assume that was possible? Like, why would then, like, Vin, Ellen, every fucking Allomancer who was able to burn one, like, a missing who could burn one metal, like, why would you assume that you couldn't burn all the metals? That stuff to me, I was kind of like...
But I totally understood, but like the basic answer is like years and years and years of indoctrination. Until Kelsier and their experiments, they thought there were 8 base metals, and that was
That's
it.
True.
Like that was the whole thing. And they had the awkward mismatched pairing of like ATM and what were they using to do it before? I forget. Anyways, point is like it's because the Lord of the Ruler was suppressing the information so heavily, and because culturally they just like kind of adopted that as like, yes, this is how this goes.
Yeah.
There's a lot of unlearning that they had to do before they actually got some of the answers. Like in all honesty, they probably would have gotten at some of these answers earlier if they didn't have all of these years of conditioning them a different way. Mm-hmm. And that's something that is true of a lot of people, by the way, in a lot of aspects of life. Like if you have a different way in which you do things and assume that you do things, it's a lot harder for you to start from scratch than it is from someone who's actually fucking starting from scratch.
Yeah.
And maybe that person would have gotten there quicker with some of those like, connections.
Fine.
I think that that's a cool little like tidbit ahead of time. It doesn't matter that much in the overall plot. You didn't need to have this Yeoman reveal as an ATM missing to be able to have it all happen at the end. But I did think that was a cool little precursor that I didn't even recall happened in the, on my first.
Was there anything that happened in like book one or book two that maybe it wasn't necessarily like a huge breadcrumb to like what was going to happen at the end, but was like a conversation? I know you mentioned the Kelsiers, like there's always another secret, but
yeah.
Was there like something else that happened and or like seeing certain things that, I don't know, made a little bit more sense, or you could like say, sure. Oh, was that Ruin that did that and shit like that?
The Conjurer conversations with Lynn was, or Lynn, with Vin was a big one for sure, because that was something
good friend Lynn.
You know, from Bob's Burgers.
Yeah. Oh my god, imagine. Oh my god,
Lynn is a misborn, holy shit, yeah. I think that like that was one of the ones that I thought I was like, oh shit, yeah, that's like actually a part that I didn't realize we touched on as much as we did earlier in the story. I'm trying to think of some of the bigger reveals now. I mean, the earring.
Oh.
The earring is such a great plot point. That is in from the very beginning of the book. And again, what I love about this is that it's another two-stage reveal, because you have this voice that's always in the back of Vin's head, Reen, her brother. Like she's remembering his words and how she can't trust anyone and all these things. And that is then revealed when she's trapped in that the storage cache in Phaedrex to be Ruin, and he's talking to her through and like and she realizes that like that voice in the back of her head the entire time was Ruin. That's fucking crazy. But you don't really know why she's talking to Ruin. Like you don't understand why she can manifest Ruin's voice and presence and everything like that. And it isn't until later when you get that the extra reveal, the over the top reveal of like the earring is not just the thing that was talking to Vin the whole time, but the thing that was blocking her from drawing on the mist as well.
I
love the very simplistic like logbook entry from Sazed. Like, and you don't know it's him obviously at the time. Yeah. Like, but because, and I do want to ask you about that in just one second, but that it's like that it explains the whole thing that like, you know, her mother killed her sister, who was a seeker, and then gave her the earring, an allomantic spike, and that was the reason why she was able to pierce copper clouds, which has been something that's been also in present since the very first book.
Yeah, so, that was a really cool connection. I also liked how that connected with Zane having the shard of metal in him that's only brought up once and then never again. Like, that kind of stuff.
It's very careful, right? Like, he doesn't harp on it too much to give it away, which is interesting, because I think we'll talk about Sanderson as a writer in a little bit, too, but, like, he over-harps on some things, if you ask me, for sure. But he also does a good job of leaving his plot devices a little bit kind of alone so that you don't really read into them that much, and then they actually do work as bigger reveals.
I also really liked that Ruin actually had control of the Kolos. And that he was, and then when Vin was figuring it out of like, oh shit, we have been leading him to everywhere that he's been wanting to go.
And she flips it and she's like, you could possibly think we were that stupid while they've been that stupid the entire time. Yeah,
I did like that. I wish that the Vin and Elend not telling each other everything would have been a little bit bigger of a thing. It felt like the only time to me where it actually seemed to matter was the ATM conversation. Like the, like, okay, let's give him the ATM. Like, we have to do it. And Elend was like, yeah, let's give him the ATM. But other than that, like, it didn't super, because they had that conversation of like, hey, don't tell me what you're doing. And then Vin was captured for like, like months. So like, it felt very, but like whatever. Yeah.
And that part drags a little bit to me as well. Like, not that it doesn't make sense as like a plot device and everything like that, but it feels like it lasts like a little too many pages for what it does.
Yeah.
But I do think it does end up mattering at the end, because when Vin is in God form and she's trying to affect things, but she really can't, because she doesn't, like, A, she has no experience with it, and she doesn't have the tools that, that Ruin does with the spikes implanted and everything like that. And so what she has to use is her connection to Elend. Mm-hmm. And her connection to Elend, like, when he says, like, go outside and, like, find... Basically, she gives him instructions on how to find the Contra homeworld, or home area, caverns, etc. Because he hears, like, a voice and gets a feeling, and he goes with it because he's learned to trust Vin. And that's a big... That's a big like character dynamic that is set up in this book and does allow for this particular like plot point to make sense, instead of being a deus ex machina, like, oh wow, he found the cult, the Contra world because like someone told, because God told him to or something like that. It's not just that. It's specifically the connection and the belief and trust in Vin that lets him do that.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting. We've been reading a lot of religious books recently.
Accidentally, right? Accidentally. In this case, at least.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting this book to be as religious as it was.
Yes.
It felt very... And normally, whenever I hear, like, religious books and or... I just have a... It just... Big turnoff for me.
Same.
Like, same. It just feels... It feels very preachy. It feels very everything like that. I don't think I've ever read a religious book, like a trilogy like this. It's like high fantasy where it feels so removed from like the real world. But also like the last like 150 pages are super fast paced, like you were saying, but it also is like so Christian.
So actually, this is something I have not brought up for a reason, and it's for this conversation. Brandon Sanderson went to BYU, and actually is still an adjunct teacher at BYU, actually.
Really?
And at one point, I don't remember if they were super good friends or if it was just like a brief thing, but he was roommates at BYU with Ken Jennings of Jeopardy fame as well.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, so... I do not know the depth of Sanderson's like commitment to religion and his or how much it influences everything he does and et cetera, et cetera. I know he did a mission at BYU and he went to BYU and he goes back to teach there. So he obviously is religious at least to a degree. And I think the thing that keeps me from like running away from that kind of potentially preachy nature of a religious story like this is that it's not that this is the right way or the only way or like the everyone has to have belief. It's pretty contained to Sazed through the story, which is the important part for me. And I had this in my notes as well. It really depends on how much you think Sanderson is speaking through Sazed as like, you know, the main character, or if you think he's simply a viewpoint that someone could have and that is right or wrong according to that character. And for me, I'm willing to just, I like this story enough that I'm willing to let it ride and be like, you know what, like, I don't think he's necessarily saying that, like, you have to have belief and dependence on religion is the only way you get, you know, morality or persistence or, you know, like, resistance or anything like that.
I think it proved that it truly doesn't matter if you have belief. Like, if it is going to be, then it'll be, you know, like, it's not necessarily about like what a certain person believes in. I mean, like, maybe for Sazed because he literally was God.
And I, Exactly, but also his whole journey is about disbelief and about a lack of faith, or at least mm-hmm. towards the end, and just as it is about an appreciation for and teaching of faith, like yeah. earlier on as well. And like, I don't necessarily buy the complete character flips that happen with him.
I don't either.
I get how Sanderson sets it up. I think it's a little bit of like, he needs to do this for the plot and where this character is going, and therefore he decides to do it this way. And like, I don't know how much the evidence really bears it out. At the same time, like, man, whatever.
Who really I mean, cares? That's also, I think that has a lot to do with the believability of the relationship between Sazed and Tyndall.
Yes.
I think it really has to do with like the believability of that relationship, which to me didn't have a very strong connection. Like it, okay. like it didn't, to me, that relationship didn't hit because it wasn't that long happening. And it just like didn't necessarily make a ton of sense. Like, I mean, it made sense, but like, oh, yeah. I wasn't as invested into it as I was with like yes. other relationships, especially because like we talked about for in the Well of Ascension, it was basically the same relationship as Elend and Vin, but with Tyndall and Sazed. Like, it yes. was a replica of that. It's very similar. Like, yeah, obviously it wasn't exactly the same. So I think it was hard for me to be like, okay, well, it's just like a little mini mirror image of like what, and I guess maybe it was like literally a mirror image of what needed to happen in order for ascension to happen. But
I mean, the only reason Vin sacrifices herself to destroy Ruin is that Ruin kills Ellen. So I mean, yeah. like that part is like if you want to talk about death being required to create Ugh. Change, then like, you know, there we are in both cases.
One of my favorite, this isn't my favorite scene, but I think a scene that was really cool for me was when Elend came back from fighting the Kalos army on his own, and he was yeah. wearing all like covered in blood and ash like black. And yeah. black, and it made the people around him feel very uncomfortable because they had never. And then he had the thought, he was like, yeah. "Oh, these people have never seen me fight. Like these people have never." I will say it still does make me mad that Elend became a Mistborn. Whatever, you can have it. Fine. But I thought that was a very cool moment and very like visceral. So it did like mm-hmm. a lot for like the reader for me.
That's fair. Did you have a favorite scene now since you touched on that very briefly, or you or just like a couple of them that really, you know, did something for you?
Yeah. So I have two. One that really did something for me, which was like super subtle, it was a Marsh chapter, yeah, and it was when Marsh killed the writer who had the metal plate.
Yes. Oh, Goradel. Yeah. Right. The yes. By the way, I love that he got his own little moment where he volunteered for that mission in the first place. Yeah. Like that. Like I actually made a note about it because I was like, you know what? It's really cool that Sanderson takes the time to tie off even some of these very minor loose ends mm-hmm. and to give a character like that like
that
a
little scene. Moment. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I thought that scene was not necessarily. It was necessary. But yes. the way that it was done with, like, not even naming who it was, but, like, you just knowing as a reader who it was, it,
yeah.
I loved that it gave a lot of responsibility to the reader to understand yeah. what was happening. And it also, like, looked at Marsh's character arc. And it just keeps on making Inquisitors so fucking scary.
Yeah.
And, like, it takes nothing off the table. I will say, like, the moment where you realize that what's on the metal plate needs to be read, like, out loud, was a mm-hmm. cool kind of, like...
For Ruin to understand it.
Yeah. And then Marsh having those thoughts of, like, oh, shit, can he just, like, not read? Like, is this fool yeah. just, like, illiterate?
Is Ruin illiterate?
Is Ruin illiterate? Which, like, adult illiteracy is a really big issue.
Let's be very clear. That's totally fair for anyone who's going through that.
But maybe like for a god to be
yeah.
illiterate.
And you're right, though. It is a relatively small small chapter, but I really enjoy it for A. Because A, like, man, Marsh gets fucking shafted so hard in these books. Like, so fucking hard. God. But that scene does give him the clue that eventually lets him be, like, the co-hero of, like, freeing Vin from the prison, essentially, that she was in. Or at least he pulls the plug out of the drain and lets her actually ascend to where she needs to be as well. So, yeah, I thought that was... I agree. That's a small but really cool scene.
Yeah. What about you? What was one of your favorite scenes? I have another one, but I'm trying to remember exactly where it was.
So this is a scene that's both incredibly camp and I kind of enjoy it. And it's when Vin and Ellen attend the ball, the first ball in Phaedrix.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one.
It is very camp. It is kind of ridiculous because it's such an audacious and, like, over the top thing. And they even make note of it in that chapter where this sounds something like Kelsier would do, Vin. This is the kind of, like, person that he rubbed off on you a little bit as far as that goes. And I think that's really, I think that is kind of like the camp part of it, because, like, come on, like, okay, sure, there's still balls going on, they're gonna, like, everything is put in place for this kind of thing to happen, but it also was a cool scene and it was well executed and it let you have a little bit of that first book back in this third book, even though we're in wildly different circumstances now, because, like, the first book has such a charm to it in those scenes when Vin is trying to be, like, a spy in the nobility while she's trained to be a Mistborn, and while you still have that, like, heist element going on behind everything as well. And so it was cool to get some of that, like, that they're doing back in the story. And so I really enjoy that as a scene.
That was it. My other one is when Tensu takes over Kelsier's bones again.
Yeah, that's so good.
I thought that was, because I just pictured Tensu, who I love. He is, like, he's funny. Mm-hmm. So I can picture him, like, getting into these bones and being like, okay. And, like, walking around and then, like, being seen by the first, like, people, and then, like, having that, but then being like, I need to get the fuck out of here. Like, and then when he runs into the other people and he's like, go over there, like,
you need to hurry up and get out of the city so I can change bones.
Your god commands you to go eat food over there, don't look back.
And what's great is they make a point of when Ellen gets to the terrace encampment and the refugee encampment near the pits of Hathsin and near the Chondra homeworld and everything like that. Those two soldiers are the ones he interviews to say for why he met Kelsier. And he's like, even if they didn't actually see him or not, like, who fucking knows? But, like, they got here and they brought everyone here and brought supplies that kept people alive and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. So it all tied back in yet again, which is really cool.
And then I did love when Tensu, like, was getting rid of the bones. And he was like, ooh, like, those feel a little spicy. Like, some spicy bones. Like, maybe...
I might need these in the future. I'm going to put them in a bag.
And he gets a little knapsack.
He'll go around with a JanSport just to make sure he gets the Kelsier's bones with him.
Have you ever seen those videos of those dogs that go on, like, really insane hikes with, like, their people? And they also have backpacks. Sure. And they're, like, carrying their own water and carrying their own dog food. And they're just like, do-do-do-do-do-do.
The only time I've ever seen, well, not the only time, but the first time I remember encountering something like that was a dog named Moose wearing one of those, like, little jackets with the
Moose
compartments. At St. Patrick's Day in Southie in Boston.
God.
And it was all a backyard party as opposed to, like, an out in the streets party, thankfully. But it was a lot of Moose running around at, like, hey boy, come here, and then pulling one of the, like, the Natty lights or Coors lights, whatever, out of the little pockets there. So
I went
Tensoon's dope, by the way. But
a dog show in Portland, Oregon last weekend. Which was the best decision of my life. Anyway, I met a whole bunch of really awesome Great Danes. Like, also just, like, a great sentence to say anytime. Great Danes are my favorite dog. I love them. They don't live that long, which is a bummer. And I understand it.
No, it's,
and I,
like, get it. 8 to 10 years.
And then every time I'm like, I want a Great Dane, they're like, you know that they don't live long. Like, yeah, I know they fucking die. Okay?
But you also know they're a great apartment. Well, you have a house now, so that's okay. But they're actually relatively low energy, so you can have them in apartments.
They use their energy to exist because they're so big. Exactly. Anyway, But one of the Great Danes actually had like a little backpack thing on it. Yeah. He wasn't being shown. He was there in support. And he was fucking huge. I'm 5'9 and a half. His back came up to like my hips. This Jesus. Was a big dog. Anyway, but he had a backpack. And that's what I pictured, because they're also a very similar size to wolfhounds, which
I was going to say, yeah,
there were wolfhounds there. Immaculate.
Big, yeah, wolfhounds are amazing.
I love big boys walking around on four, nope, with paws. I was going to say, big boys walking around on all fours is a very different vibe. Very different vibe.
Well, so the American pegging convention, you know,
yeah, gotcha. And that I went to with my aunt, who you naturally go to things like that with.
Great Dane's your favorite dog?
Yeah, Great Dane's my favorite dog. I mean,
Rottweilers.
Oh my god, have I told you about our next door neighbor's Rottweiler?
Have you?
You can meet him when you're yeah. here visiting. His name is Desmond.
Oh, good name.
And he is. They also have another dog named Max, who is a wire terrier mixed with a corgi.
Oh wow, that sounds interesting.
He is the cutest fucking shit in the world. Anyway, Desmond is also very cute, but Desmond is huge, very big boy. Yeah, and Michelle has taken him to so much training because Rottweilers are considered, you know, heavy yep. air quotes, yep. considered to be an aggressive dog, which is all about how they're trained and all about their mm-hmm. owners. And so she's gotten him like super duper trained, like insanely trained. Like you can like literally like grab his face and like do whatever you want with this dog. He is
smoosh his jowls and whatnot.
He is the cutest dog in the fuck. We'll have him come over and he'll like run around the backyard when you're here. He's dumb
big,
cute.
Big fan. I'm already very very much looking forward.
Oh my god! And also my dad's next door neighbors, not really breed, but like. They sure. have had a couple of litters of Rottweiler puppies. So if you ever want, I'm sure that Stella would love a Rottweiler.
Stella would fucking hate a Rottweiler. Stella would hate anything, but yes, I think that would be towards the top of the list.
Yeah. Anyway, so if you want to in.
Noted. Very much noted.
Yeah. I can be more than your podcast friend. I can be your dog friend too.
Because currently you are only my podcast friend.
Yeah, we only talk about podcasting.
We actually don't talk at all outside of this. We only talk during podcast recording times. Yeah, of course.
I don't even know how I know you.
No, at this point it's all a mystery,
all a mystery.
Speaking of mysteries.
Oh.
Nah.
Oh man, I thought you had something.
Well, so much of this book is like intentionally wrapped in mystery and intentionally yeah. like designed to get us to like it's all giving you again breadcrumbs the entire way.
It's giving breadcrumbs.
This point. And I love that like you have we've barely talked about Spook, although that's obviously a big part of this book.
Yeah.
I love that he has a very direct impact not just on writing that metal plate but also on getting people down to the caverns to make sure they're mm-hmm. safe, as well as, of course, his actions while being spiked are not unimportant, obviously. But like that, a lot of that in terms of the overall plot point payoff yeah. is to get that information to Vin or to someone like Marsh that ends up, around Vin.
Vin, which was a great little twist. That was when Marsh was like, "Get the earring out." That yeah. was like. So fucking important and such especially a good
because,
moment.
Especially because you know that, like, you get the idea from early in the story that, like, he's trying to save up his, like, rebellious, like, nature to, like, pull his own... To commit suicide, essentially, yeah. to deprive Ruin of him as a tool. And so because that's what he's trying to do, you know that's not what's actually going to happen. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you know that we're not actually going to get that being his cumulative moment from all of this.
There's also no way that would have been able to happen either. Like, just...
yeah, and so it's like, all right, so what's it gonna be instead?
What's
and
it gonna like, be? Yeah.
And I'm not saying that, like, the whole time you're thinking about that actively, but yeah. I think there is at least part of it that you're like, okay, well, where is this going? And when he does use it, it's in the most important time possible. So like all of this again is interconnected and comes back together. So you have the Utrio plot, and you have the Phaedric City plot, and you have, you know, a lot of the other things, you know, kind of actually paying off properly. We don't want to let this go too long. I do want to ask you, like, after this whole series is done, like, did you have a favorite character or not even a favorite character, because there's so many like obvious main characters. So let's not say favorite, but like a character that you enjoyed that like wasn't necessarily the biggest deal, but you really dug.
So I think because I was reading these. Okay, so I have two. One of them isn't as intense. Okay, so I think because I was reading these as I was listening to The Adventure Zone. To me, I read Breeze as Taco.
Okay, yeah, I can see that.
And so, like, I just, like, really had a connection with Breeze, and I really loved Breeze. I think that Breeze, to me, was the saving grace of the second book.
I fully agree with that, too.
So I think, like, overall favorite character... Ooh, it's a tie between Tensoon and Breeze for me.
Okay. Tensoon's a great one, too. I'm glad you felt the same way. Yeah Tensoon's a great character.
He just, like, knocks out of the park. And then I loved, like, just how much of the contraculture we got to see.
Contraculture.
A great EP. So I think that those two would be my favorite.
I love that we got like a manic pixie conjured dream girl, like with the with his like friend from like that ninth generation or whatever, who's got like the alt body.
Yes, I like that too. But yeah, so I think those two would be my favorite. Breeze to me didn't have the biggest payoff in the third book, so that's the only reason.
Oh no, agreed.
He got like really nothing, which was kind of a bummer. He had some of his quips. But.
The second book was obviously his time to shine, much like the third book was Spook's time to shine. Yeah. I think Sanderson did those in stages as opposed to building them to something bigger. I think that's fair.
I really wanted Spook to be my favorite. And I do love, see, I like that he's now a Mistborn. Like that was earned to me. That made sense to me, and I was like very happy about it. I also love that Sazed was like, "And you're really fucking handsome." Like, and by the way, I really fixed you.
cute boy
over there with his like new little princess queen thingy. But anyway, who is your favorite character?
I mean, it's really hard for me to not just like Kelsier so much. Like, even when the other books like try to talk about how bloodthirsty he was to the nobility and everything like that, like it still makes a ton of sense, and I don't fault him at all, so I don't really have a problem with that. I think it's also kind of like a cop-out answer, because he's just such a... He's supposed to be this force of personality that obviously has a fucking religion built on him afterwards, so that's a little unfair. I mentioned earlier, I really like Yeoman in this book. And the reason I like Yeoman is not because I think he's the best character himself in every scene or anything like that. What I like about him is more about what Sanderson doesn't do with him. He doesn't make him unreasonable. He doesn't make him like secretly a bad guy.
No.
He doesn't make him he doesn't give him any kind of reason for the reader to like, oh, boo, this fucking guy's in the way, and he's being a very, like, he's unfounded in his religious belief, but he is a very reasonable one based on, you know, the fact that this guy's lived for a fucking 1,000 years and has basically acted like a god. It's totally fair that he would have this impression of the Lord Ruler. And I like that he isn't just randomly killed off afterwards as well. And I know it sounds like a dumb thing, like an unrelated thing to a characterization, but it is a big deal in terms of how Sanderson sees that character. Because rather than him just like fulfilling a function and then being like, meh, you know, yeeted out a window or something like that, or over the city walls by a Kolos, like, it is good that you have a character that can stand in direct opposition to another character, at least for a time, for one of your main characters, and then actually be a reasonable person themselves and not be like a baddie in disguise or just surplus to requirements afterwards.
Two things. One is I liked how he actually was like the only really faithful one to the ruler. Why do I always forget that guy's name?
The Lord Ruler?
Yeah.
Rashak?
Lord Ruler. I don't know why. Anyway.
Because it's a dumb fucking name, if I'm being honest, but whatever.
So, I like that he actually was, like, the most religious, like, the most, like, of a follower towards the Lord
because
Ruler.
Because you can't call the Inquisitors religious because they were controlled. Yes,
exactly. And he, like, really believed, and I loved when he was like, yeah, the Lord Ruler isn't dead, though. And everyone's like, yeah, we fucking killed him. And he's like, no, like, he just wants you to think that he's dead.
But did
he's,
you?
But yeah, but he's not dead. Like, you didn't really do it. So, like, that, yes.
He's making that Daenerys face, like,
really? cute. What, you said a sentence during that monologue that you just had.
Okay.
Which was, I can't remember what it was, but it was fucking pure perfection. And it was,
okay.
Shit, fuck, piss. That wasn't it. You said something that was really funny. And I wanted to give you credit for it.
Getting yeeted out of a window or over the city walls? That's the only thing I can think of that was
intentionally funny. No, it was something else. Something like a bad boys. Like, bad. He's not a bad, like.
He's not a baddie.
He's not... Baddie in disguise. Baddie in disguise is going to be my first.
EP.
EP.
That's a demo you sent around. Yeah,
that is going to be.
That should already be a Cardi B album. If we're being honest,
you mean a Danny B album.